Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates! You found Primates Tracks. Congratulations! Find us on the interwebs, why not? At Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. PrimusTracksPod at gmail.com is the email address. There is also a Facebook page, and it is run by the captain of Team Envelope Filter himself, Frankie.
Hi, Josh. Hi, guys. Please follow the Facebook page. There's always cool stuff there that you will not find on the Instagram page. So imagine if you're attending a Primus show during this latest tour, and somebody tells you, did you see that awesome photo from Primus Tracks? And you will say, which one? And you'll have no idea what they're talking about because you don't follow the Facebook page. So you have to follow both.
Don't be bad.
Very important.
Frankie is fomenting fear of missing out among the Primus Tracks faithful to get them to follow his social media page. And I think it's brilliant. You did hear the protestations of a third voice, though, and that would be our pal Luis Ortega, who's going to help us out with Tragedies of Coma today.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
And we should mention, of course, Luis is bass and vocals on with Rapscallion, an L.A. area Primus tribute band. You've got the street cred here. You've got the chops. Are you ready to tackle Tragedies of Coma with its clanky clean tones and its envelope filter madness?
I'm ready for all the clankiness, and we will talk about this envelope madness.
Oh, man. I should start calling him Lewis the Company Man. He's really good at going along the lines there. As we often do, we have lots of business to take care of before we get to the track itself. We have some miscellaneous debris related to last episode, Eternal Consumption Engine. I received a lengthy email, Frankie, at primustrackspod@gmail.com from Gino, who had a lot of input on what Jay Lane may or may not have been playing in the studio. Certainly didn't sound like a standard drum kit, but he sent an email with all kinds of photos of Jay's kit from his Primus tours. Gino says, "Hey guys, I just wanted to shed some light on the percussion discussion for Eternal Consumption Engine. Of course, I wasn't there when they recorded it. Who knows what they actually used? But based on what I hear and what I've seen of Jay's live kit, here are my guesses with pictures. For the bass drum, Jay had a very large kick, way off to the right by his floor tom, with the big felt beater on the pedal, which would eliminate a lot of the attack of the hit. Tim does the same thing occasionally. I would guess this is what he's using here. It's definitely not an octobon that he uses. As we talked about, it lacks the tube echo sound of an octobon, but he has a similar tom past his floor tom by the bass drum. When I saw him play live, he was turned to that side of his kit, which he probably had torqued the living feces out of, brain style, to make it high-pitched. The bells that Josh was inquiring about, and Anthony mentioned he thought it was the long round cowbell type instrument, I agree with Anthony on that, would most likely be a go-go bells, a Latin percussion instrument also used by Neil Peart. For other various pingy sounds, Jay's live kit had a stack of Rototom rims, no heads, just the rims. Tim also used these mostly on the Wonka kit, and two actual frying pans, and he actually provided pictures of what looked like upside down cast iron frying pans on the drum kit, which is incredible. He says only Primus knows if these were present in the studio, but he definitely used them live. He goes on to say, however, to amend, the first live clip you played was definitely played on an octobon. I noticed on the first tour of Jay, he didn't have octobons when I saw him, but on the Green Naugahyde tour and 3D tours, he finally broke down and bought two of them. But I stand by my opinion that it was not an octobon on the record, but probably is live. Whew. Wow. Now, there's some minutia for you, Frankie.
Jeez.
Gino, you freak.
Thanks.
Nice job,
thank you
man.
Very much.
This guy's taken long-range photos of Jay's drum kit back in 2013. It's pretty incredible. So we have all kinds of great information from Gino. Thank you for that miscellaneous debris.
Yeah, personally, I miss Jay Lane. I miss seeing that guy drum.
Oh my gosh, watching him drum was a treat. I was lucky enough to be on the rail for one of those shows, and just watching him work was incredible pleasure. It was a great time. I don't recall seeing a frying pan, but I didn't have a great angle, of course, because he was raised higher than me being on stage. So keep those emails coming, primustrackspod@gmail.com. We don't know everything, but we pretend to.
Yeah.
You sat around long enough, Lewis. We're going to jump into the track here. Tragedies a coming. Track 5, Green Naugahyde, checks in at 4 minutes 52 seconds. That actually surprised me when I saw the timestamp on that. For some reason, it feels shorter. Credited to Les Claypool, Larry LaLonde, Jay Lane. Sounds like they jammed this one out in the studio as they put the record together. This was also the first single from Green Naugahyde and the first video that made its way to YouTube from this album. I say YouTube because, of course, there are no music videos anywhere else anymore.
They don't exist. Nobody wants them.
That's right. If you want to see a music video, you go to YouTube. If only there was a TV channel that played music videos all day and night. Something. I think people would really be into that.
Yeah, something like music television of some sort.
Music television is a great name. You know what? I am going to try to secure some investors.
That's a solid venture.
I hope you're in on this, Lewis. And Frankie, empty the bank account. We're going for it.
Oh,
Frankie, I think you've got live history and more on this guy.
Yes, I've got some background on this song. Here it goes. Premiered on May 24th, 2011 at Stubbs, which is actually a show we have sampled on previous Green Naugahyde episodes. A very nice audience recording. Performed heavily in 2011 and 2012, particularly because they were doing the back-to-back album runs, with only 3 performances in 2013. The song was one of several new ones tested on the audience as part of what Les called the Guinea Pig Tour, with a notable performance at Bonnaroo where one of the strings on his dobro broke. A music video was directed by Les and Mark Kaur, filmed at the Anchor and Hope restaurant in San Francisco. Primus Tracks veterans will recall that we had an extensive and fascinating conversation with Mark Kaur, yeah, where he went into detail about this music video. I highly recommend that episode if you're interested in finding out all the behind-the-scenes details of this production. Regarding the lyrics, Les said, "Humor has always been a big defense mechanism in my family. There's always been a strong element of humor, and a lot of us are funny. But there's also been a lot of loss and tragedy and substance abuse. I had an uncle who did speed for 30 years, went to prison, and died at 50. So he obviously wasn't someone you would give your car keys to, but the guy was hilarious. And I have a cousin in prison, but we've always moved through it with sarcasm and humor. Satire is a powerful tool. The characters that have moved in and out of my songs have often been tragic, but they are also compelling and humorous." He also said in another interview, "There's a lot of crazy shit in my life right now. My mom is fading away. Yeah. She's not going to be around much longer. My little nephew was diagnosed with leukemia at only 2 months old. I have friends battling cancer. When I wrote that song, I was just like, holy fucking hell. The funny thing is, the music to that song is very uplifting. I love the contrast. From Tommy the Cat to Wynonna's Big Brown Beaver, there's a lot of tragic figures in my music. It's just the way I exorcise my demons, through these kinds of people. As for not making a music video too overt, I thought of this perspective of a lobster that is facing impending doom as he watches fellow lobsters disappearing from the tank. And he would rather be somewhere on a beach singing this song. Here are 2 pieces of trivia, Josh. The horse that you see in the video was lent by Leanne LaJoy, former Primus manager."
Right. And, oh, wow.
Yes. And sadly, that horse has already passed away.
Oh.
And the second piece of trivia, Josh, is that when the song was revealed, there was a very peculiar contrast in the fan base. Some people were beyond thrilled to listen to a new Primus song and witness a new music video. And at the same time, I would say that some people were, I'm not going to use the word disappointed because I think it was a different feeling. I guess some people were a little baffled about how much the song reminded them of a previous track. Can you remember which one?
Oh, okay. So yes, it is. It is a Brain song. Wasn't it compared to Ballad of Bodacious?
That's right, Josh. You nailed it. Yes, people kept comparing tragedy to Bodacious.
Didn't Anthony do that for us? I think he did that not long ago. He kind of transposed the lyrics from one onto the music for the other, and it fit pretty well. So I do remember people complaining that it was treading similar ground, and, oh, they're just repeating themselves now. But, you know, I do hear the similarities, but I think they're pretty darn different.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair assessment for sure.
Good.
I think it's unfair to call it like a ripoff. Like, I certainly, it didn't strike me like right out the gate as, oh, this is a total copy of this other song. I didn't get that. No.
Yeah, I think they're similar enough, at least in as far as BPMs and maybe a little bit of the rhythms, but not too much overlap for me.
Yeah, it's like blaming Primus for sounding like Primus.
I like that. Another designation this track had, and I think this was coined by Toaster because he was one of the first guys to tape some of these shows where these new tracks were being premiered, at least in the setlist circles before this record came out. This one was referred to, before anybody knew the title, as New Isley. So that's
New
how
Isley.
Yeah, so that's how it was being referred to for quite some time, because it was reminiscent, I suppose, of Isley Brother style bass lines, I suppose. And I don't know much about the Isley Brothers, and I don't know much about Marvin Isley as a bassist. I think he was the bass player, at least. We do know Les has quite a steeped repertoire as far as R&B goes, and we know that he's covered
Climbing Up the Ladder.
Yeah, he's covered Isley Brothers and Sly and the Family Stone and a lot of those bands that those are the kind of bands you know they're a few of their hits because they play them on the radio, but turns out the Isley Brothers have like 36 albums. They have so many records, it's out of control. But, you know, and most people know the tune It's Your Thing, which is a friggin' banger of a tune, but that's the only one a lot of people know. And I will confess, I don't know too many other than that one. Do you know the Isley Brothers at all? Can you make a comparison there to what you're hearing as far as at least the bass part or maybe the overall vibe of this tune?
Well, what comes to mind is for Isley Brothers, for you guys, are there any songs that come to mind at all?
I picked a few, and I'm just going to play, I can play a few seconds of a few of these, and I was just kind of picking and choosing and just listening to the bass lines, and I heard a few here and there that were kind of reminiscent, at least of the bass, but not of the entire
picture.
Yeah, because
I'm going to say, like, I don't think Claypool was influenced by the song Between the Sheets or anything like that. I mean, that was one of their heavy hitters, but I can't hear it though.
Well, I did mention It's Your Thing, and it's one of those where if you listen closely to the bass line, actually, you might kind of hear some parallels. So you tell me, Lewis, being the expert bass player, I'm going to play just a few seconds of It's Your Thing, and let's all listen to the bass line.
I'd say the first thing that comes to mind is the phrasing, although it's a little bit opposite, because I find that Claypool, he phrases a lot of riffs that he'll go heavy on beats one and two, and then he'll kind of drop out on three and four to give it that room.
Yeah.
And in this song, it sounds like the bass part is really emphasizing beats three and four, but it's kind of quiet on beats one and two.
Hmm.
So I hear a similarity there in a way, phrasing wise.
If I play a few seconds of the track That Lady, I wonder if you're hearing anything in this bass line that might cut across. Once again, not an Isley Brothers expert by any means. Oh, and then we'll listen to Between the Sheets in its entirety.
Yay!
Great tune. I'm hearing some cool stuff from the bass line there.
The songs are fantastic.
The Isley Brothers kick ass. I need to really dig into them. Tragedy is a pretty groovy tune, so I just kind of felt that groove going on. I didn't hear a ton of similarities in the bass lines, but I just felt that groove. And I think this is part, you know, this is part of where Les is getting that groove feel from, you know, as a young man playing this kind of music with the Tommy Crank band and that sort of thing. So.
Definitely the funk side. And wasn't he doing a bunch of like disco or funk songs in the 80s, right, during high school or after high school? And they called him Disco Less. and that's where he got his thumb developed, because he was doing a lot of covers of like disco songs, basically, or funk songs.
Essentially, yeah, he's doing a lot of R&B and kind of some funk, I think, and that a lot of that was with the Tommy Crank Band right out of high school. Yeah.
Oh wow, Tommy Crank! So that was the band that he was working with at that time.
He was in the Tommy Crank Band for quite a little bit, and I remember him saying he was the youngest guy in the band by far, and he felt like he needed to prove himself, so he worked really hard and really got groove oriented and really picked up his rhythm there working with those guys. And I think that's still a working band. I actually recently talked to a guy from El Sobrani, who a really good jazz guitarist. He's from El Sobrani, went to De Anza High, and I mentioned the Tommy Crank Band. He said, "Oh, that's a great band. They're still doing stuff." And I was blown away by that. So I just threw those out there, Lewis, because I was curious. Once again, I don't know much about Isley Brothers, and it makes me want to go out and buy a bunch of their records and really groove on them. But I think I can really hear the groove that Les is establishing here in Tragedies A-Comin'.
Isley Brothers. And to think that he suggested Isley Brothers as covers to work on with Metallica.
Right, yes. I don't think we ever got the name of the tune that he tried to lead them in. We just know that he said, "Hey, who wants to play some Isley Brothers?" And
Lars was not amused.
The rest is history.
Good.
Right, yes, we wouldn't be here today. But I would say that this track is pretty unique in the Primus canon, because it really leans into that funk groove. And I remember when this record came out, I asked a friend of mine who's a really old school Primus fan from the early 90s, shout out to Shani, and I remember her telling me that this one was her favorite track on the record. She called it a booty shaker. I have to agree, as much as I can shake my booty anymore without, you know, having some kind of arthritic episode. it really is. And it really, I remember, it definitely got some crowds going in some of the footage I've seen. I don't think I got this one live over the years, but, Lewis, you got that bass with you. What are we dealing with musically here?
Well, I mean, I was trying to figure out what key he was going with. I mean, it sounds like he's throwing on, I mean, not surprisingly, he throws in a lot of what they call, I guess, accidentals or outside notes from a core key. I was thinking maybe he's in G sharp minor, because he starts off with E, like natural, and then G sharp, A sharp, and then B. But, you know, they kind of modulate a little bit into different areas. But yeah, the root of it tends to focus around E, and he kind of vamps off of that. Mm-hmm. I guess I could play the first four phrases. So you have that lick. I guess the core lick is really just this. So to repeat myself is.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun to play.
It does. It is a lot of fun to play. it was just, I think I'm thinking about it as I'm playing, and that's what I'm doing, which you should never do. But because right, I'm trying to.
No, I totally understand. I was talking to somebody the other day about something like that, and they said, you learn it, and then you forget it, so that you can actually play it.
Yeah, exactly. And when I've watched a lot of the live footage of them performing Tragedies A-Comin', of course, Claypool is doing many variations. With this one, he really goes, he ventures out. He plays mm-hmm. it pretty freely. The solo tends to be very different every other time. But for the most part, it tends to be those two riffs that carry it through. And so it's like an answer and call. The first one is part A would just be.
Yeah.
That's part A. And then part B is. And so that's A and B. Then he goes back to A again. And then the second time around on B, part two would be. And then after that, he goes back to part A again. And then the last B would be basically.
Yeah, that big bend. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And that comes immediately after the last, I would call it part B of the riff.
Yeah. So that part you're playing right now, you're playing it clean, and it sounds really great. The first part you were playing with your A's and B's, that's that cleaner tone, but it's kind of clanky on the record. So, and Frankie, you mentioned the dobro, so I...
Yeah. I believe he did record that on the dobro for that added clankiness. And then he, I've seen him perform it on that dobro many times. I don't think I've ever seen him play it on a pachyderm bass. I don't know, Frankie, have you seen it?
Nope. It was always on the dobro.
But then you were starting to play that second part, which on the record is with the addition of the dreaded or lauded, depending on who you are, or just neutral envelope filter. So it's very different. It sounds very different the way you're playing it with that clean tone, because it's, for me at least, I think I'm distracted and it's hard for me to tell what the hell's going on sometimes when he's got that envelope filter on. So I'm curious what your thoughts are as far as that goes, Lewis, like trying to learn something like this with that envelope filter on.
Yeah. It did take me a number of listens to try and cut through the envelope filter because it can be kind of tricky on the ear because it's such a heavy texture. And it can kind of, I don't know if it'd be fair to say, kind of manipulates the pitch of the notes as well, sort of in the same way as like a chorus effect kind of bends a note for the very character of the chorus sound effect. I believe he did that just to add more of a dynamic. And I think it kind of helps to subdue the sound of his bass playing a little bit as he's singing simultaneously. So that's my speculation is I think A, for dynamic, and B, so as not to kind of overpower his singing or outshine his singing while he's doing the verses.
Oh, that's interesting, because I often think of the envelope filter as a feature that he would put front and center. But in this case, you're saying it gives him a little more sonic space for his voice?
Yeah, I really think so. Because that whole song, he's staying really busy, similar to, I would say, maybe going to his solo album from Of Whales and Woe and thinking of Do You One Better. That song as well, he's constantly playing different riffs almost the entire time as he's singing. And Frankie, do you recall if he had, I'm trying to remember off the bat, if he did play with the envelope filter on I'm Gonna Do You One Better, or I think it was that one.
Yes, there's definitely envelope filter on that one.
Yeah, and but I hear what you're saying, Josh, because you know, like all of us, we've seen Primus do their thing on stage, and there are moments where Claypool will utilize the envelope filter for more lead sections, or when they go off into their psychedelic improv jam sections, which I adore. I'm not sure how to put it, but I guess it just adds that texture. And but in this case, I think it kind of helps to kind of settle it down a little bit while he's singing over it. Would imagine if he's playing and it's bright and clean while he's singing, I think that wouldn't mesh too well. But that could be a matter of opinion, of course.
I picked up on that Primus reference. Apparently last week Frankie threw in an opera and such, and I totally glided over it and didn't catch it. And a listener commented on our Instagram on that, and I was really upset with myself for not catching it. So thanks for laying that one out there for us, Lewis. I appreciate it. You know, there's something else going on. The clean tone is really clanky thanks to the dobro, and then the envelope gives it that different texture. But when I think of like really clanky bass, the first bassist I ever heard who was able to achieve that clanky tone was Steve Harris. Okay. Or not achieve it, but the first one I heard. So Steve Harris of Iron Maiden, like really, he was able to really dig into that clankiness. But, you know, Les is like really pushing it out there with that dobro.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, I don't think he could get any brighter without it sounding atrocious.
So he's right on that fine line to you.
Well, he knows his threshold, and he plays it well. Because I think Claypool has been very noted as someone who plays with a really sharp mid range in punch, and then on top of that, you add the dobro, which has that super bright, almost metallic sound to his bass playing. But he does it really well, because When I've personally experimented with bass tones and trying to get that brighter sound chasing after the Claypool clarity, bass tone wise, it's super easy to sound chirpy. I don't know how else to describe that. But if your high ends are too hot, it's going to sound like really high pitched bird chirps, and it's going to kill your eardrums.
Okay.
Or you'll even get feedback. There's been a few times where I performed and I got feedback from my bass because I had the tone so high end cut, or not high end cut, but so hot on the high end. But Claypool manages a really nice threshold where he'll keep it really clanky yet punchy. And it's not bright to the point where it kind of makes you want to put your finger in your ear, like I've heard some bands. But no, he does it well, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Okay. There's one more bass part, and it's right at the beginning of the tune. And you know, we always talk about this guy as a percussive player. He's kind of given us that one chord, and he's percussing on it. What's going on there? I'm not sure what chord he's hitting, and then he gives us a little chromatic run, I think, with some strumming on it. Is that right?
So basically, he's playing your typical 1-5 or an open 5 chord, or some people call it power chord.
Okay.
And it's on the 9th fret. It's a B note followed by a G flat, or you can call it a F sharp, mm-hmm. depending on how you look at it harmony wise. Or to put it simple, 9 and then 11.
There you go.
And then you strum it with your fingers striking downward. Oh, but I did miss that slide though. So he would go from when he slides from that 9 on the D string, and then of course 11 on the G string. You keep your hands down, and then you're going to slide it all the way down, where you're now going to be fretting the 4th fret of the D string, and then your other finger is going to be on the 5th fret of your G string. So it's a little bit awkward, and this of course is the Primus trademark, the tritone.
Yeah.
So, and then after that, you want to slide from, I believe it's the 7th fret of your E string, which is the B note. So, whoop.
Nice. There's that slide. Yeah.
Yeah. I apologize. I believe it's off the 7th fret. He slides after the tritone. But yeah, that's kind of the intro riff, of course. It's just a couple of simple power chords, and then you just finish out on that tritone on the 4th fret of your D string and 5th fret of your G string.
And it's kind of cool that you know, the structure of the tune, those would be the three main bass lines, other than the curiosity of them inserting of this track of Les soloing live, which is so cool that, you know, because they toured on this track, of course, and then inserted Les playing a bass solo during this track before the album came out onto the studio version of the track, which is pretty rad. So I like that idea. I'm sure it's been done before, but that's a cool idea too. So you've got those three main parts that you've modeled for us, and then that neat bass solo. But I love that he comes back around just to that rhythmic pounding part. I guess I'll call it a rhythmic pounding at the risk of sounding perverted. But we get that under the... Larry guitar solo, or at least part of it too. So we get our A's and B's and C's and all these different parts coming back around on one another. And I think that's what surprised me when I looked at the track length of 4:52. I went, damn, I thought this was like a 3-minute song. I want to play the first 15 seconds because there's that percussive riff, and then Larry's doing something that might sound familiar to some people, or at least maybe you might make an association to what I made an association to here. Boom, there it is. So Larry's doing this pull-off lick thing. You know, he's fretting a note and then just coming off of it to create an open string sound. And first of all, I wanted to remark upon the guitar sounded pretty clean. Now, there's some effects on it, but it's fairly clean sounding, especially for Larry. But that intro riff that he's doing sounded like a particular guitar riff. And I mentioned Steve Harris earlier with his clanky bass. That what Larry's doing is reminiscent to me of this Iron Maiden lick from Flash of the Blade. What do you think, Lewis?
Oh my gosh.
Look at that.
I'm going to have to say that's probably where it came from.
I do wonder if that was the inspiration. Now, you know, people do a lot of those kind of pull off open string type things, but just given the notes that Larry's hitting, I imagine there was some kind of synchrony there. But it's kind of cool because it's almost like if this track was you know, had an Isley Brothers inspiration on the bass and an Iron Maiden inspiration for the first guitar riff, what a weird mashup.
Such as Primus.
Such as Primus.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. And who knows if that's the case. That's just where my mind went, I think, one of the first few times I heard Larry's part on that track right there. I'm actually surprised that during the verse where Les is playing some envelope filter business on his dobro, Larry's actually playing during the verses, and he's not just skanking. He's giving us kind of a cool little lick, fairly chromatic in the background there. I'm going to see if I can find that one, because I think it's a nice counterpoint to what's going on with Ye Olde Dobro. Not that, but that is the cool main groove right there. Where's a verse? Let's try this. I got the very end. Let's try it again. It's all Frankie's fault. Here we go. So that's pretty cool. I don't know. I love humming or just scat singing Lur stuff because it's so goofy. I love that. That's a great little line right there.
It fits. It's kind of like a call and response almost. Like the guitar and bass are really bouncing off one another in that section.
Ooh, great observation. Yeah, they are. I don't know how musically what they're doing is similar, but I feel that call and response idea. As far as how they're kind of they are kind of going back and forth with one another that way.
So groovy.
That's the thing. It is a groovy tune. You know, you got a groovy chorus, you got groovy verses, you got a groovy main riff. We even have an extended Lur solo, and it's the weirdest thing to me. This solo is not too memorable for me. Going back and listening to this track for the first time in a while, I just went, oh, that's the guitar solo. it's strange. Like, usually I'm just like, Larry, you're brilliant. You can do no wrong. And then I went, oh.
I want to point out that something I really like about the solo is how it goes back to the intro riff. I think that's very clever.
I do appreciate that. Yeah, he brings it back around to the intro riff, so we get to hear that part again. And that, I think, is a nice resolution to it. You're right. Also want to, of course, salute the groove machine behind the drum kit, and his name is Jay Lane. I'm just going to play this 15-second little clip here. I think it's under the solo, guitar solo, that is. 2 minutes, 50 seconds. When you said earlier, Lewis, that you miss Jay, that's one of the reasons I miss Jay. That just sounds so cool.
Yeah, and I got to say, I've never seen another drummer in concert mesmerize me with their hi-hat work than Jay Lane did when I saw them during the Oddity Fair tour.
Sure, yeah.
Oh, yeah, where they brought out, like, I guess Claypool went to Burning Man Festival for the first time, so he kind of wanted to bring that back on the road during that era. And, it was, oh, my God, I can't explain it. I was hypnotized by his hi-hat work. Because there was this moment where Claypool and Larry kind of just dropped out very gradually, and it was just him just hammering away doing his thing. Yeah, and anyway, I'm gushing, but yeah. Jay Lane's great.
And that's no disservice to Tim Alexander. It's just that all these different drummers bring different dynamics and different vibes. They all made great music. And that's what
Tim's a monster. No, yeah. No argument there.
I think a Primus big band with three drummers would be pretty sweet.
Yeah, like King Crimson version of Primus.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. All those
kids. I don't think the world's ready for that much power.
Well, I want to forward to the bass solo. As I said, they spliced in a live cut from some show. I don't think it's credited as to where that which date it's from. I'm sure some investigative Primus fans could find it through audience recordings. Do you want to play that? Because I want to hear what you're hearing, Lewis. So. I do like the
live audience thrown in takes me back to the 90s.
Yes, very much so. I wonder if they put a little sugar on that with that for the audience noise there, but you never know.
Yeah, I always wonder where that live audience audio came from. Do we have any word on that?
Oh, it had to be from the Guinea Pig tour, before this record was finished, and they were playing these tunes. I would assume this was while they were guinea pigging this very track, because it just matches the groove. So it had to be on that tour prior to the record dropping, and then they just spliced it in. Probably last minute, I'd imagine. True. But as far as that solo goes, it sounds really clean. Like, he sounds very, it just sounds very precise, what Les is playing, and I wonder if he was particularly pleased with what he achieved there. What do you hear?
I would have to say that he is, because, as you said, it's very articulated, well-defined, and each line is almost its own, it has its own character. It kind of makes me think of Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower, where each guitar solo has its own character or personality. Mm. It's almost like three different guitar solos. And this, he, of course, I mean, it's all on bass compared to a guitar, but there's different phrasing in each line, and they're all different, and they have their own character and different phrasing. So although I know most musicians who record their albums, it's such a compromise for them to say, okay, this is it. This is what I'm going to lay down. This is what's going to be on there forever. So yeah. That's got to be such a tough compromise. But I think with Claypool, I think he had a general concept of, you know, I'm going to approach it this way. What can you do for a bass solo? Well, you know, let's give it some character. With the envelope filter, it almost sounds like the bass is trying to talk to me. I mean, as trippy as that may sound, but in the same way that Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower guitar solo went, he had different effects there, a reverse effect, wah. Then he went with more of like almost a flamenco like strumming pattern that he did towards the end. Yeah, again with Claypool here, I hear almost like four mini bass solos going on.
Tall task to recreate, I imagine.
I would say a tall task to try and even create.
Oh, create. Period. Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy. It's easy to cover somebody else's work, but to be the one to say, okay, this is what I'm going to create. You know, I mean, where does that come from?
Mm-hmm. Not much. I don't have much else on the vocals other than I hear an old man voice in there for some reason. But then I love the way he's leaning into that bullet mic as well and kind of sounding a little creepy with it. I mean, he's singing about death. So I think he wanted to get a little creepy with it to contrast the upbeat music, as Frankie cited in one of those interviews.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like Sting's Every Breath You Take is a total creeper song, but it sounds so lovely.
That's right. Yes, beautiful music. The message is totally fucked, but but darn it, people, yeah, and they still play it at high school dances, right? So there's that too.
Yeah, go figure.
Which is the perfect breeding ground for criminals.
I got a question for you guys. Have you noticed how... in terms of the sound, I mean, the tempo is different, but in terms of the sound and the way that Jay is playing the snare and combining it with the hi-hat, have you noticed how it's pretty much over the falls at a different speed, particularly when it was performed live and it was introduced with drums only?
Lewis, you first. I'm curious.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that there is a similarity going on with Over the Falls with the snare sound of Jay Lane on Tragedy?
In a live context, not in the studio recordings, but performed live, sometimes Jay would start Tragedy with drums only, and the band would join later, as opposed to the studio recording where everything kicks off together. And we're going to hear some examples when we get to the live cuts of today, but it just occurred to me that at a different tempo, it's remarkably similar to Over the Falls as it is performed live.
And I definitely I'm with you on that one, because early in the conversation, I definitely hear a similarity to the Brown Album era with Tragedy and some of the twanginess going on in this album. So I think there might have been some musical reference points made by Claypool or Larry, saying, you know, we're going for this kind of sound, you know, let's reference this, and because I feel this direction. So I wouldn't be too surprised if that's actually the case. I think that's a good observation.
I wouldn't have put those two together, but that's why Frankie's here, to challenge my thinking.
Frankie!
And open me up. Thanks, Frankie. Interesting. I mean, you do kind of have a kind of a straight ahead groove, and now they're different time signatures, but that doesn't necessarily stop them from sounding similar, or at least having a vibe. So maybe you're onto something.
The vibe is pretty similar.
Well, I can't wait to hear these live cuts then. Before we get to that, we should briefly talk about the lyrics. Frankie, you cited that interview information from Les about what was going on in his personal life, family, friends, and that sort of thing. In general, with these lyrics, when you look at them, boy, what he has to say seems to hold water, because we look at our chorus, you know, tragedy's coming, I cannot step aside, can't run and hide. The damn my bastard pride part, I suppose. Pride goeth before a fall, as they say, so I don't know if that's what he's going with, but it's amusing that he says, damn my bastard pride. I've never heard pride described with bastard as an adjective before. I think that's pretty great. Actually, when I was going back through these verses, there's four of them here, and it's funny because in the first couple of stanzas, it seems like death is arriving, because we're talking about tragedy, we're talking about death, because it's, he rides in all alone, he's grinding flesh and bone, he plays a steady hand, tinges of poison from his glands, if you ask him nicely, perhaps he'll go away, but then, of course, at the very end of the second verse, it's, he'll teach you how to die. So we're talking about death, which is one of those, it's one of those all-encompassing universal themes or topics that anybody can relate to, because it's going to come for us all. When we get to the third and fourth verses, it's almost like fast forwarding through the stages of grief to me, because we have, with the stages of grief, the classic ones, you have denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And it seems like the third verse is all about denial, and the fourth verse is all about acceptance. Like, he just kind of fast tracked us through this without making it too long of a tune. The third verse, we have, she stands before us with Bible in her grasp, opens up her mouth, you can hear the wretched rasp, bucket of barnacles, she's abrasive to the skin, like the ignorant masses that hope that someday she'll win. So it's, I don't know if we're talking about the power of prayer or faith or that sort of thing, but it does sound like denial too, because we're hoping that she'll win through whatever it is, the power of prayer, or that she'll make it out of whatever it is, could be a terminal illness. Fourth verse, when tragedy's pounded hard against your door and the cancer's eaten at your inner core, you're feeling helpless, can't control the game. Do you fade away softly or go out in a ball of flame? So that sounds like acceptance, right? Death comes for us all. We all die. It's a universal constant. I can accept that. But I have a decision to make. How am I going to go out? Right? And I don't know about you guys, but to me, that recalls that famous Dylan Thomas couplet from his poem, Do Not Go Gentle in That Good Night. That last couplet, do not go gentle into that good night, rage, rage against the dying of the light.
And it's kind of a at least some bit of a power that you get to have towards the end, regardless. Tragedies. The song is basically about the inevitable,
right?
And how it greets you along that way,
right?
And then of course this song tails out lyrically. It's like, well, how are you going to end this, or how are you going to go out on this one?
Right.
You know, because there's nothing you can do.
Exactly. Yeah. Accepting that fate, but making the choice to live a certain way and defy it, and up to the point where you expire, like the ball of flame. Yeah, that's a great point.
So at least you get that bit of power towards the end. So I guess that's the bit of hope. That's the shiner in the song. Because it is a pretty dark song.
Yeah, you're right. There is a little bit at the end. So it's one of those things that's make the most of your time. That's why I'm likening it to this Dylan Thomas poem, which has that similar central theme. And it is one of the more well-known poems that's out there in the English language. So don't know if that was a inspiration at all or if it was parallel thinking, but they definitely mesh to me. Are you guys interested in hearing Dylan Thomas read that poem?
Do it.
It's like a minute and a half. We've talked about Iron Maiden. We've talked about the Isley Brothers. We might as well bring in Dylan Thomas.
Do it.
And his booming voice.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
He's the ball of flame. in the Primus lyrics, for sure, right? That's what he's exhorting. Fantastic reading of it. A lot of poets, when they read their own poetry, they sound stilted and like they're reading something for the first time. But Thomas certainly knew how to deliver some poetry. That was wonderful. A little closure on him. He was a horrible alcoholic and died at the age of 39 or so.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how much. He raged all right.
Dang, you've got a deep voice for a 30-year-old guy.
I think he was living pretty rough for a bunch of years there.
So, great poem. And I think it definitely has a lot of relevance towards tragedies that come in. So good call.
Thanks, man. All right, Frankie. We have ourselves a nice groovy, funky Primus track here, but I'm sure it sounds pretty great live.
All right, Josh, what's the first one?
Our first cut's from Gathering of the Vibes.
He was mesmerized by the flying neon spaghetti, I think.
That was this one? Gathering of the Vibes was the neon spaghetti?
Yeah, I think they were passing around like neon light sticks or some kind of like very bendy light sticks that were multicolored and bright.
What's your portion of tragedies coming from that show? Oh, I hear what you're saying about that drum tone. Variation there. I like that intro. I see what you're saying now about that Over the Falls.
It's got a false vibe, right?
I was hearing it there. I get it now. I'm understanding your, wild and crazy machinations now, finally.
But it's such a groovy drum line. Like, I'm not surprised that, hey, why don't you open it up with that powerful drum groove and then we'll just drop in.
Yeah, it's really ballsy. It's just kind of straightforward and ballsy. I like it. Pretty strident.
Ooh, nice word.
A strident tone. looks like we also have Frankie wants us to hear some envelope filter fills. Okay. All right. Lewis, earmuffs. 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
That was like a slow motion fart.
So, Frankie, what drew you to those envelope filter fills?
I just love the variation compared to the studio recording.
Yes, there was definitely variation. And he kind of kept a lower end there as opposed to going up and noodling around in the higher register, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, he kept it more like an underpinning for everything else that's going on.
Yeah. You know what I like, though, about this live sound is it's a nice recording because Larry's got a little bit more on his guitar there. So there's just more sustain. There's more beef there to it, or meat on the bone, I suppose. Jay sounds great. One of my complaints about Green and Naugahyde is that the drums don't sound altogether fantastic to me. But that live recording could really hear the dynamics of Jay's kit and what he's doing. So I think these live recordings redeemed the record for me in some ways.
Yeah, he sounds huge.
He looks huge too. our second cut is from a radio station appearance, and this is not just any radio station. This isn't your clear channel bullshit, Lewis. No, sir. This is WFPK, an independent radio station out of Louisville, Kentucky. And if you don't say Louisville, they'll call the cops. Okay?
Oh.
You have to, Frankie, you have to say Louisville. You can't say Louisville, okay? And it's definitely not Louisville.
No, don't confuse me.
Yeah, that's right. So it's Louisville.
That's not my bill.
I brought this one along for two reasons. One, that being a radio station, the quality is fantastic. And number two, because you will hear a different take on the intro. On our first live cut, it was kicked off by drums only. This is a different way to start the song. You'll hear what I mean.
Aw, yeah. So listen to that hi-hat there. Oh my God, it's beautiful. Ah. For your ear, is it pleasing to have, like on the studio track, the band all start at once, or to have the drum intro it, or to have the bass intro it? What's working for your ear?
You know, that's a great question, because from my experience performing live with various bands, you kind of have to gauge the room, and you got to gauge the vibe, is what that means. And so sometimes you'll be like, you know what, maybe we need to emphasize the energy from this direction, hence the drum intro. Or, hey, we're doing a straightforward performance gig, which, you know, point in case the radio performance are doing here is more to the point. I noticed that Claypool for live shows, he'll elongate the intro a little bit more to have more of a buildup. And I think, yeah, that's basically what they're doing. All these differences, these variations, I think all has to do with what setting they're performing under and what the vibe might be calling for. So I think that's where they're pulling from direction wise. So it makes sense to me.
I suppose it's a good way too. So you don't have to count him in. He's just going to do the bass intro. And, you know, those guys have been playing together for years. You know, he played with Jay for so many years, you know, in the past and different acts. They know each other. They know what they're doing at that point. Right.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Without question.
So it's not going to throw anyone. Yeah. I'm going to forward in this radio recording to a little bit of Lurland.
Ooh.
Thank you. Ooh, I like that bass fill there. And we're back around, Frankie's favorite part. Nice. No! There's envelope filter. It has to go.
Some very intricate J-Lane work, I gotta say.
Yeah, that sounded great. The Lurland part, once again, like that sounded a little bit better than the studio version of me, but for some reason that solo doesn't land on my ears 100%. There is such a cool groove going on around it, and then when he comes back to his main lick at the end, it does bring it full circle, so I do like the structure at least. Nice find, Frankie.
First thing that comes to mind is I'm happy that they decided to release the album on my birthday. on September 13th, I was waiting forever for a new Primus album. I was trolling the ye old billboard and searching high and low for any scraps of a potential new album. And so I was very happy about that. Secondly, it was another, well, obviously it was the J-Lane era, and grateful for him zapping some more energy back into the Primus camp, because I read in many interviews Claypool really appreciated his hop to his rhythmic playing. He always would make a point to discuss in interviews during that era. And they talked about how his energy kind of helped made them feel more, I'd say, enthusiastic or charismatic about the whole thing through and through. The last thoughts, the one thing... I guess I'd say it was definitely their twang era. It was the introduction of Lur going on Fender guitars almost exclusively, if not entirely, changing his amplifiers from Vox and Marshall amp combos down to, I think, Orange amps, or at first I think he went with 5150 Van Halen red face amplifiers. He totally switched his rig.
Right.
And, then of course, Claypool unveiled the Pachyderm bass during that era. And that was an interesting venture. It was a totally different sound of Primus. Other than that, with Tragedies of Coming itself, really cool. As we all pointed out, it was a very strong theme, kind of a dark theme that he coded or clothed in a really bouncy groove almost. More of an uplifting, almost kind of vibe is how it was delivered, in contrast to the lyrics. And it was a very personal song. I guess for me, I loved when I first put on the album for the first time and I heard Tragedies Coming for the first time. I remember thinking, oh God, I love how hard the bass line drops when it finally enters after that intro riff. So
yeah,
that was a cool moment. Nice. So, but yeah, that's my piece on that.
For me, it's a fun track, but it's just another track on Green Naugahyde. I mean, Liz cited that it's the song that the majority of the people that had heard the album were attracted to, so it got chosen as the lead single. I mean, I understand the song having a music video and being a single, but I wouldn't have chosen it as the lead single to represent the album. I would have gone with something like Hennepin Crawler, of course.
How did I know you're going to say that? I think we all knew. Everybody listening right now is going, I knew it! Well, it's memorable and it isn't at the same time to me. It's a strange track in that sense. But it does make me want to go out and live my life to the fullest. Tragedies are coming. Let's reschedule for another day because you've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, be careful what you put on your TV.
I'll be checking how Brad and Angeline are expanding their family, Josh.
Thank you, Primates. At Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter, PrimusTrackspot@gmail.com. Lewis's band Rapscallion, I believe, is at LA Primus Tribute on Instagram, correct?
Correct.
Thanks again, Lewis. Appreciate it, as always, with your bass expertise. Later days.
Really makes.
Step aside.